If Jesus came to your house to spend a day or two, if he came unexpectedly, I wonder what you'd do. Oh, I know you'd give your nicest room to such an honored guest, and all the food you'd serve to him would be the very best. Oh, I know that you would keep assuring him that you're glad to have him there, but when you saw him coming, would you meet him at the door with outstretched arms and welcome to our heavenly visitor? Would you maybe change your clothes before you let him in, or hide some magazines, or put the Bible where it's been? Would you turn off the radio and hope he hadn't heard, and wish you hadn't uttered that last loud and hasty word? Would you hide your worldly music and put some hymn books out? Could you let Jesus right in, or would you rush about? And I wonder, if the Savior spent a day or two with you, would you go right on doing the things you always do? Would you go right on saying the things you always say? Would life for you continue as it does from day to day? Would your family conversation keep up its usual pace? And would you sing the songs you always sing and read the books you read? And let him know the things on which your mind and spirit feed. Would you take Jesus with you everywhere you'd plan to go? Or would you maybe change your plans for just a day or so? Would you be glad to have him meet your very closest friends, or would you hope they'd stay away until his visit ends? Would you be glad to have him stay forever on and on, or would you sigh with great relief when he at last was gone? It might be interesting to know the things that you would do if Jesus came in person to spend some time with you. He's here with us today now, so we spend some time with him together, with him and his word. And hearing from the Apostle Paul, he writes to a church that was meeting primarily in homes. And he uses that word agape that we don't use in our homes very much. But agape was known as a word within the Christian world. Reading this amazing book recently called Jesus and the Secular World. The fastest growing religious group in America is the religiously unaffiliated. Over 30 million new people have cut the cord, so to speak, with any church denomination. 30 million in America. Are we relevant? Are we growing as a church? Many of whom they're just apathetic, cynical, or even hostile towards the church. We're living in an increasingly post-Christian culture. Just look at any awards show and the best picture and the values and the morals that they're in that best picture. You get and the art that is being sold at the highest dollar value. And 156 million Americans are not engaged with the church at all. And the thesis within this book is that we need to learn how to communicate to people who are biblically illiterate. They are not able to understand it when we talk to them about the values which the Bible espouses. Non-Christians can range from positive to indifferent to hostile, yet most outreach efforts are focused on reaching those who are already open to the idea of God. And that is symbolized when Paul goes to the secular places in Greece. And he realizes to them that there are values within our culture. Our culture has the values. They may be apart from the Bible, but they are clinging to something. The first thing that they're clinging to is secularism. And the ideas of the progressive nature of humanity and this ideal of a utopia. Relativism is also a pillar within this post-Christian age. And here's something that aligns with biblical virtues in a way. Tolerance is a high value within the culture that has separated itself from the church. And we just read about what tolerance looks like within the church. And guess what? When it's revealed within the church, then we won't be able to hold the doors closed because they'll be banging to get in when they see and experience genuine love, as Paul is asking the church to have. Am I off track in saying that? That churches that are healthy grow naturally because they're magnetic with the love of God? And so in this passage, we have Paul using the word agape. Let love be without hypocrisy. That is a challenge to all of us who are not in the acting profession. You see, because that word hypocrisy is the word that they would use to describe those that portrayed in the theater. Other versions say, love sincerely. And that is a great challenge to us as humans because at the very core, we are selfish and filled with pride. And every act of love that we extend even comes from a motive that is ultimately going to benefit us. And we got a holiday coming up on Monday. Do you see how I did that in quotes? It's the holiday. But it's a real thing. Ladies, am I right? It's a real thing. It's tangible. You can quantify it with distress or eustress, depending on how you come about it. Eustress meaning the good, anxious, nervous anxiety of a good event coming up, like preparing for a test or a big community event or even coming up here in public speaking. When we love from a place of selfishness, or if we don't understand that our love comes from a place of selfishness, then we're not being sincere in the love that we provide to others. Is that logical? Like if it's a blind spot for us, when we try to reach out to someone or maybe make amends, it can come across as insincere. So Paul is, this agape that only comes from God is meant to be received and then given. I like this version of a paraphrase, and it's so small, I apologize. It's from The Voice. Love others well and do not hide behind a mask. Love authentically. I'm going to try and explain in the duration of my sermon to how God can help us take off the mask. So relevant these days, isn't it? Oh, we love it when an illustration matches and everyone understands what that means. Love without a mask. Love authentically. Despise evil. Pursue what is good as if your life depends on it. Live in true devotion to one another, loving each other as sisters and brothers. Be first to honor others by putting them first. Do not slack in your faithfulness and hard work. Let your spirit be on fire, bubbling up and boiling over as you serve the Lord. Do not forget to rejoice, for hope is always just around the corner. Hold up through the hard times that are coming and devote yourselves to prayer. Share what you have with the saints so they lack nothing. Take every opportunity to open your life and home to others. If people mistrust or malign you, bless them. Always speak blessings, not curses. If some have cause to celebrate, join in the celebration. And if others are weeping, join in that as well. Work toward unity and live in harmony with one another. Avoid thinking you are better than others or wiser than the rest. Instead, embrace common people and everyday tasks. Paul passes on this instruction to believers in the exercise of the greatest gift of all and the basic principle of all true Christianity. Love. Agape. Love. And I'd love to find a chocolatier that I could commission that word agape in chocolate and just feast on it with caramel inside of it, you know, a little toffee, peanuts. The word agape. That'd be a true agape feast. Maybe not at our cooking school. We couldn't do something like that, but we endorse a healthy lifestyle here at Woodside. The virtues that he lists in Romans 12, 9 and following are but the outworking of genuine Christian love, and it can only come from the Holy Spirit. All happy families are alike, but each unhappy family is unhappy in its own way. Should I repeat that? All happy families seem to be alike, but every unhappy family is unhappy in its own way. That was Leo Tolstoy. He wrote War and Peace. Knows something about unhappiness. Fought in the Crimean Wars himself. And in a community like we have here in a church, there are certain things that make up for what are known as loving relationships. And this can be quantified within the church. You can measure how loving your church is. Loving relationships are the heart of a healthy, growing church. Jesus said, people will know we are his disciples by our love. John 13, 35. Practical demonstration of love builds authentic Christian community and brings others into God's kingdom. It's magnetic. Unfeigned, genuine, practical love endows a church with a much greater magnetic power than all the marketing efforts of the world. I affirm Woodside Church. Whenever I go somewhere and I tell them that I'm a pastor, someone says, I visited that church. They're so friendly there. I'm passing that on to you. Because I got to tell you that if they're telling me that, I'm not the only friendly person, right? And I'm not sometimes, I meet you and I see you, and sometimes I don't even get to say hi to you, but I want you to know that I love you. Growing churches manifest a measurably higher love quotient than stagnant or declining ones. And so, those are the four main aspects of loving relationships. Affirmation and encouragement. Atmosphere of joy and acceptance. That makes for a loving church. Deepening relationships. Like when a family grieves. Paul says to grieve with them. When a family rejoices, we rejoice with them. And, dare I say it, conflict resolution. Oh boy, now I'm stepping on some toes now, eh? In your family, you will have conflict. I can prophesy to you today that conflict shall arise. And the Bible does not urge us to avoid the conflict. In the nation of Israel and in the stories of the Old Testament are all about families and groups and individuals who managed conflict. And conflict arose right at the very first bite of the forbidden fruit. I talked about that last week, how the conflict is within ourselves, between ourselves, and with above. And then we get that external pressure of a tempter who is customized. And we're vulnerable on all sides. Moses, the prince of Egypt, embroiled in conflict right from the outset. And it was his mismanagement of conflict that caused him to miss out on the blessing. And in our homes, when conflict arises, where are our barometers for progress? Here's a story of the division of the land in Joshua chapter 14. After Jericho fell, a few other cities, how God had led them. They were about to divide up the land. And, as you know, Bible scholars, only two men survived the wilderness wanderings. One of those men was Joshua, the son of Nun, and the other was Caleb, the son of Jephunneh from the tribe of Judah. Joshua chapter 14, verses 11 and 12. He says, I am still as strong today as I was in the day Moses sent me. As my strength was then, so my strength is now, for war and for going out and coming in. Now then, give me this hill country about which the Lord spoke on that day. For you heard on that day the Anakim were there. Those were the giants, with great fortified cities. Perhaps the Lord will be with me, and I will drive them out as the Lord has spoken. Wow. What a faithful proclamation of who Caleb and his tribe were. Not in the strength that they had, but in the strength that God had promised to them. He made an oath to them. And Caleb remembered that oath. Can you remember? Waiting for 38 years Do you think he scoped out the best property? We know how to assess, you know, what we want to look for in a parcel, right? We have these things that we want. And for Caleb, he claimed that promise. Everywhere that your foot treads, I'm going to give it to you. And so he claimed that land. There was another tribe, Ephraim and Manasseh. Actually, chapter 16 and 17 describe how the half-tribes of Ephraim and Manasseh did not have the faith. Because they had their numbers had swelled, and the borders that Joshua had assigned to them was not sufficient. And Joshua said, hey, if you want to go and take it. And they would not. And here's what Patriarchs and Prophets says about that contrast between the faith that the tribe of Judah had through Caleb and these half-tribes. The power of the God of Israel had been pledged to his people. And had the Ephraimites possessed the courage and faith of Caleb, no enemy could have stood before them. Their evident desire to shun hardship and danger was firmly met by Joshua. That's sometimes what we do when we just avoid conflict. It's a trait that Jesus embraced. When he knew that there was no honor for a prophet in his hometown, where did he go? He went back to his hometown. In John chapter 2, he actually disrupts what was relatively stable in the economy of the temple. Been going fine for old Annas. And the high priestly fable of the Messiah was a profitable thing. But then in John chapter 2, Jesus comes right after and during the Passover, right after the wedding at Cana. He found those who were selling oxen and sheep, the money changers, seated at their tables. He made a scourge of cords and drove them all out of the temple. Jesus created a boundary around how God was being portrayed, because he knew that what was happening at the temple was not the adequate character of God. He says, take these things away. Stop making my Father's house a place of business. Jesus drew a boundary around that place. And did they learn from that, Bible scholars? Did they learn from that lesson? Or did he have to go back again 3 years later? And with the same authority, this time with tears in his eyes, he's telling the woes on the Pharisees. 8 barriers that they would put in between the people and God. But watch this nuance that John the Beloved gives in this gospel. He talks about Jesus, and in verses 23 through 25, I have it here in the Contemporary English version. In Jerusalem during Passover, many people put their faith in Jesus because they saw him work miracles. But Jesus knew what was in their hearts, and he would not let them have power over him. No one had to tell him what people were like. He already knew. Jesus had even a boundary within himself. He would not let the flattery of the disciples or the reception of people discount who he understood he was. And that leads me to talk about what are known as boundaries in the last. And I'm going to just summarize it up. Boundaries define us. They define what is me and what is not me. And in the back of your bulletin, we have a little notepad there. Who is this sermon about? You can write your own name there, because that is what this sermon is about. It is about who you are and who God says you are and who the devil is trying to trick you into thinking that you are. When you draw a boundary to the devil, God is going to fortify that boundary, okay? Just like he did with Caleb and the tribe of Judah. A boundary shows me where I end and someone else begins. And so if I know my own boundaries, then I can respect and honor your boundaries, and that therein lies the golden rule itself. We have boundaries all around us. Our skin is a boundary. I even broke my boundary this morning when I was shaving a little bit. We have words that are boundaries, words like no and yes. Those are boundaries. Jesus said a lot about that, because he said, let your yes be yes and your no be no. And many scriptures urge us to say no to other sinful treatment of us. In other words, that boundary of abuse, I will not be abused in this way, is a boundary. We have the boundaries of truth. We have the boundaries of geographical distance. We have the boundary of time. We have emotional distance is a boundary. Other people are boundaries. Our attitudes and beliefs form our own boundaries. May even be blind spots for us. Our behaviors are boundaries. People perceive us and they see us in one setting and they categorize us and then they see us in another setting and they say, that's unexpected. Just because we're in a different setting. Other people are boundaries. Consequences become boundaries. Feelings are boundaries. Values are boundaries. Limits, resources and gifts, thoughts, desires, love. Look at a boundary that God asked the Israelites to place on their doors. In Egypt, after the ninth plague, God told Moses that each family was to take a lamb. And they were to take that blood and drain that blood from that lamb. And they were to take the branches of the hyssop tree, the cleansing medicinal herb of the hyssop tree, and take the blood and spread it on the doorpost. And when that angel of death, Pharaoh, was creating a boundary to God's people, Moses was there to say, release the boundary. We know how that story ends. The angel of death passed over the blood. The concept of boundaries comes from the very nature of God. And due to time, I'm going to just talk about this and what Paul says in Romans 12, verse 3. For through the grace given to me, I say to everyone among you not to think more highly of themselves than they ought to think, but to think with sober discernment, as God had distributed to each of you a measure of faith. So, I like to say that we need to think in the light of Scripture. In other words, when we cope with our daily, what would the Bible have me do? And so, when we want to raise our self-awareness, we ask ourselves, what are my limits? What can I influence? What is beyond my influence? Which boundaries am I overlooking in others? Are my boundaries extending beyond my borders through my actions, my behavior, my values, my consequences, my actions? We need to take responsibility for all of the above areas of our souls. Matthew 7, 5 in the Sermon on the Mount. There is that word actor again. Jesus calls us actors. First, take the log out of your own eye, and then you will see clearly to take the speck out of your brother's eye. We are to be self-aware. And remember the boundaries that were in place at the story of the Good Samaritan? He was traveling and some people had encroached his boundaries by assaulting him, taking his possessions. His boundaries were violated by those robbers. Left him for dead. Levite came by and said, I'm not going to break my boundaries by touching that guy. I've got my boundaries. And that guy's outside of my border. Did it say a priest came by? A priest? A representative of the people before God? He must have misunderstood his boundaries. Quite see the neighbor in need as within his borders. And then the Samaritan. A stranger come who is outside of his territory, yet shows compassion for him. And that's what the text says. Who was more neighbor to him? The one who showed compassion. Love sincerely. Paul restates that. In a word, we must do everything in our power through all the possible varieties of circumstances for our neighbors, which we would wish them to do for us were our situations reversed. The golden rule. And so, very quickly, the 10 laws of boundaries. Number one, the law of sowing and reaping. Our actions have consequences. Number two, the law of responsibility. We are responsible to each other, but not for each other. Number three, the law of power. We have power over some things We don't have power over others, including changing people. Number four, the law of respect. If we wish for others to respect our boundaries, we need to respect theirs. Number five, the law of motivation. We must be free to say no before we can wholeheartedly say yes. And God gives us that freedom, doesn't He? God honors our boundaries, even when we put them up by mistake. Number six, the law of evaluation. We need to evaluate the pain our boundaries cause others. Number seven, the law of proactivity. We take action to solve problems based on our values, wants, and needs. The law of envy. We will never get what we want if we focus outside our boundaries onto what others have. The law of activity. We need to take the initiative in setting limits rather than to be passive. The law of exposure. We need to communicate our boundaries to each other. And here's a little gift, my gift to all of you on Valentine's Day. Apply these laws to your marriage and see how they change the way you relate to each other. Remember, you can't break laws forever without consequences. We all have to either live in accord with them and succeed, or continually deny them and pay the consequences. These laws will help your marriage adapt to God's principles of relationship. We can love others well and don't hide behind a mask. Love authentically, despise evil, pursue what is good as if your life depends on it. I'll close with this story. There was a Portland vase on display in the British Museum. It was perfect and incomparably beautiful. But one day, a distressed man passing through the room struck it with a stick and smashed it into fragments. There it lay, its beauty was gone, and it was a thing for pity and for tears. Maybe resembling a relationship or a trust that has been broken and shattered and seems irreparable. But one, with infinite patience and love, came and gathered the pieces together and built it up again with such genius and success that only with careful examination can the fact of its ruin be observed. That's what Jesus does when we have healthy boundaries and loving relationships. Let love be without hypocrisy. Abhor what is evil. Cling to what is good.